where we're looking at this, the sixth petition, the request that we be not led into temptation. Now, you'll notice, as we have highlighted as we've gone through the Lord's Prayer, that the petitions are related to each other in a very significant way. And this is nowhere more obvious than in this particular situation, where delivering us from temptation is linked in an explicit way with delivering us from the evil one. Now, I've highlighted from time to time the reason that it says in your bulletin, we will say the evil one, is because the verb or the word evil is not in a neuter case. It's not poneiron, it's poneiros. And therefore, it signifies not evil generically, but an evil personage. And that's why we say that. And there is a relationship to the request to be delivered from temptation and from the onslaught of our adversary. I want to read to you also this morning from the book of James, because we find the theme developed there as well, but in a different context. And I want to show you the distinction. In James chapter 1, verse 12, we read these words. Blessed is the man who remains steadfast under trial, for when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life, which God has promised to those who love him. Let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempts no one. But each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire, and when it has conceived, gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is fully grown, brings forth death. You'll notice that in the ESV, in the Lord's Prayer, as well as in this passage from James, we have the word temptation. But you'll also notice that James addresses, as he begins to make that remark, he talks about trials and test. He tells us that God does not tempt anybody. Not in the sense that God entices us to do that which is evil, because God cannot do that. Well, what do we mean then when we pray, lead us, or do not let us be allowed to go down the path of temptation? Do we think temptation is restricted, say, to what happened with David and Bathsheba? Oftentimes, that's the context in which we relate to the word temptation, being tempted to do something immoral. Well, I think the word has a much broader range, because the temptation that is being discussed here, both in James as well as in the Lord's Prayer, has to do with being tested. For example, God put Abraham to the test when he called upon him to offer up his son Isaac. Abraham was tested. In that sense, God does put us through trials and through tests. In many cases, these tests are not designed to cause us to stumble, but to strengthen our faith. Now, I want you to notice in James that James gives us what I have identified, and by the way, these will all be spelled out in detail in next week's notes, but I'm just giving you a precursor to that. The 5 degrees of the progress of sin. Notice how he gives us what amounts to is a biography of sin and how it relates to us psychologically and as persons. Notice that he talks about the drawing or dragging away. That's how the NIV translates it. And this relates to the mind. The Bible tells us that sin is deceitful. Sin is portrayed in the Bible as a thing, much like a virus, but it's not just something that's abstract. In many ways, it's sometimes personified. Sin is deceitful, and this, in turn, is a reflection on the noetic effects of the fall. What do I mean by noetic? Not poetic. The word noetic comes from the Greek word that refers to the mind, the noodle. Sometimes people talk about their brain being a noodle. That's a play on the Greek word nous. And as a result of the fall, the mind, we're told, is darkened. Paul, in both Romans and Ephesians, talking about our understanding, or the fallen man's understanding, has been blinded. We also know that Satan acts in a way so as to keep men from seeing the gospel. He blinds them. But not only is the mind affected, but notice that it says that sin entices, and this relates to our affections. When our affections are entangled, all of the willpower in the world will not stop the act from taking place. You hear about people talking about cravings for either drugs or alcohol or sex, and it's almost as if they have no willpower to say no. That's true. And biblically speaking, due to our fallenness, when the infections are entangled, the mind and the will follow suit. Now, I've used this illustration from Van Til on numerous occasions, is that our will acts on our appetites. After church today, suppose you decide to go down to the Golden Corral. Down here on Stapley, it turns into Cooper, and they have this enormous buffet in which you can go through and select your items of choice. And as you go through there, you will see a variety of items, and they cater to a wide variety of taste. You may see Brussels sprouts alongside of turnips in the vegetable section. And it may not appeal to you to have Brussels sprouts and turnips. But to other people, that would be very appealing. And if you got to the meat sections, you may find, among other things, a braised beef liver next to all kinds of other choices. Now, if you're anything like me, liver is not going to be one of the things that you choose. You know it's good for you, but what determines your choices there? Your likes and dislikes. And you will not choose to eat food that you dislike unless you have no other options or are forced to. But we do not choose in a kind of a neutral fashion. Our appetites determine this to a large extent. So when those appetites are ensnared and the imagery is being caught and entangled, the affections therefore determine to a large extent our actions. And notice how that follows. Not only are we dragged away and enticed, but sin is conceived. That is, now the will is engaged and the choices are made. And when this happens, there is what is called the accomplishment of sin, or what the Bible talks about, our habits are determined. And when that happens, sin gives forth in its fullness. It is born. And the results of that, James says, is death. You see, sin is never viewed in the Bible as something that is external to us. I highlighted in the notes this morning the quote from Thomas Watson, the great Puritan, that sin and temptations come forth from within and from without. And we wage a daily warfare, according to 1 John, with a threefold adversary. The world, that is, the world's system, the pattern of this world, which Paul told us in Romans 12 not to be conformed to. The world, the flesh, which is the Bible's way of talking about our fallenness. Even as regenerate Christians, we have what is called the residual of indwelling sin in our members, which causes us great consternation. And the spirit and the flesh war against one another. This doesn't happen with the natural man. He does not have any such conflict because he does not live in any way as it relates to the glory of God. He lives for his creaturely appetites and satisfaction. Now, he may have conflicts, but they're not the same kind. So we have the world, the flesh, and then we have the third adversary, which is the devil. And Paul says the world is being taken captive by him to do his will. So they are willing captives to do his bidding. But with the Christian, it's quite different. Paul says in Ephesians 5 that we are not unaware of Satan's stratagems or devices. And it is the responsibility of the believer to know his adversary. And if you are blissfully unaware or indifferent to the reality of the fact that you have such an adversary, you are easy prey. You can be easily tripped up and ensnared by his strategies. The other problem that we confront as fallen people is having misplaced confidences. And the greatest illustration of this is the Apostle Peter. Proverbs 28:26 says, "He that trusteth in his own heart is a fool." Now that flies against the common understanding that we have today about putting our trust in our feelings. I just trust my feelings. You know, you can all remember the advice that Obi-Wan Kenobi gave to Luke Skywalker. Trust your feelings. Proverbs says you're a fool if you do that. Because feelings and heart, the emotions, the heart is deceitful above all things, Jeremiah 17:9 says, and cannot be trusted. And if you trust your heart, if you trust your emotions to lead you in the right way, as if you have some kind of internal Geiger counter, you will be misled. You will be deceived. And you will end up being duped. Think about it, the Apostle Peter. He stands out, does he not, on the pages of the Gospels as the individual that had such remarkable experiences with Christ? This was the man that got out of the boat during the stormy sea and walked, however briefly, toward Christ. And then he began to sink. This was the one who said, "Thou art the Son of the living God, the Christ." And Jesus commended him, said, "Flesh and blood did not reveal that to you, but my Father in heaven." Peter is called the rock. And it is confession upon which the church will be built. So he has this place of preeminence among the apostles even. And he's not the Pope. But nonetheless, he has this. Now you remember in Mark's Gospel, the 14th chapter, Jesus tells his disciples that he's going to be betrayed and that every one of you are going to turn tail and run. Here comes Peter. No, not me. And he compares himself to his fellow disciples. Lord, these guys might do that. But you can tell that when the going gets tough, I'll be right there with you. He begins by comparing himself and exalting himself amongst his peers. And yet, he says, "Although all forsake thee, Lord, yet I," and the emphasis in the Greek text is pronounced, "I most certainly will never, ever do that." And Peter puts it emphatically. He's like Rafael Palmero before the Senate, saying, "I have never, ever used steroids." And then here it is just a few weeks later, he's caught with steroids. That's what Peter's like. He is boasting on his reliability. Now, you all know what happened. He was confronted by a little maidservant and said, "I know you." After Jesus was arrested, Peter was warming himself by the fire, and a little maidservant comes up. "Hey, I know you. You were with him." And again, you would have to look at the language that is in the Greek text. Peter began to call down divine oaths. Peter violated that third commandment. He swore by God Almighty, "I do not know him." If ever a man perjured himself, Peter did it there. He sinned not only in the fact that he denied that he ever knew him, but he called down God as his witness. I've never, ever been around that man. And you all know what happened. Jesus had foretold Peter, before the cock crows, you will deny me repeatedly. And the text tells us later that Peter went out and wept bitterly. Again, there is such a thing as shedding a tear. You've all had that experience. There's other thing is weeping bitterly. And the text describes Peter as being consumed with sorrow. It's interesting when you read his epistles. In 1 Peter 1:17, he says that we should spend our sojourning here in a time of fear, not being overconfident. He had learned the painful lesson of not putting any confidence in the flesh, of not boasting. Let he who thinks he stand beware lest he fall. So there is a sense there in which what we're praying for here, God, do not allow me to be put in a circumstance where my faith will fail me. It's not just simply that we do something that is forbidden. Certainly, we can be tempted that way. But more specifically, Christ is saying, pray that you do not be put through the crucible of losing your faith. And by the way, you might remember that Jesus promised Peter, you will be restored. And when you are strengthened, strengthen the brethren. You remember at the end of John's Gospel, when Jesus appeared to the disciples and he said to Peter, do you love me? Here is Peter now. All this has come flooding back into his mind. Oh, boy, howdy. Lord, he's not comparing him with anybody now. Lord, you know I love you. Three times. And it is significant that Peter, who had denied the Lord three times, is now asked three times, do you love me? And each time he has to respond, you know, Lord, only you know. And the manifestation of Peter's love for Christ is going to be seen in Peter fulfilling his function as an apostle in protecting and feeding Christ's sheep. The testing that is being discussed in James differs only slightly with the petition of the Lord's Prayer. In James, it's talking about how through test and trial, our faith can wane and we can find ourselves ensnared in sin. In the Lord's Prayer, that thought, though not as prominent, gives place primarily to the testing that Satan wishes to expose us to so that we become either indifferent to the gospel or deny it. You see, each and every one of us stand in constant need of the intercessory work of Christ who prays for us continually. In Hebrews chapter 4, you know, we are told about what a great high priest we have who has passed into the heavens, who was put to the test in every way as we are and yet never failed. And the writer says, therefore, let us come boldly to the throne of grace that we can receive grace and mercy. Actually, it's reversed. It's mercy and grace to help us in our hour of need. And I've told you that, and I'll deal with this down the road, that Satan's strategies is primarily as the great liar to convince us that something that is untrue is true and what is true is false. And so he masquerades as an angel of light. He presents a variety of gospels other than the one that Christ has given us. He tells us things that will attract our fallen hearts to embrace while turning our back on that which we really need to embrace, which is the all-sufficiency of Christ. And this is why Paul is so insistent in Galatians about other gospels. They do not help. They only hurt. And any gospel that seeks to diminish the sufficiency of Christ and faith as being the means. Listen, do you know that when we jeopardize sola fide, justification by faith alone, what happens? When sola fide, or justification by faith alone, is diminished so it becomes justification by something plus faith, faithfulness, or compliance to the law, or reliance on ceremonies, that in turn diminishes sola gratia, by grace alone, because now it becomes something that God does that we assist and help with. And what happens when sola gratia is diminished? Solo Christo is likewise diminished. It's no longer by Christ alone. It's no longer by grace alone, because it has ceased to be by faith alone. And when that happens, Satan has ensnared us. And now we look not to the glories of Christ and Him crucified, but we look elsewhere. We may begin to look inward. We begin to look at externals, or we begin, like Peter, to compare ourselves to others, in which we come out looking rather neat in the process. When that happens, we are deceived. And when we are deceived, we fall into trial and temptation, and Satan is victorious. I'm going to spell this out in the next few weeks, because I want to spend some time, because what Jesus is asking us to pray for is the ability to recognize our human frailty and our own insufficiency and our adversary's wiles, the wiles of the devil. And what his goal is supremely is to take your attention off of Christ and Him crucified and put it somewhere else. And then you will be brought down. May the Lord deliver us from His strategies. As the elders and deacons come forward now, let us be prepared to, on a weekly basis, remember Christ in the bread and the wine.